All right. I'm calling the Labor Committee to order. We have the minutes of the previous meeting in front of us Wednesday. Excuse me. Okay. Other one, other Wednesday. Okay. Need to approve the minutes of the March 6th, 2019 meeting of the Labor Committee. Representative Lippert, would you like to make that motion?
I would.
Okay, there's a motion made to approve those minutes of the March 6th, 2019 Labor Committee meeting. Any discussion, improvements? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, we have the minutes approved. First up, we have House File 1241, Representative Mahoney's bill. It's called the Minnesota Call Center Jobs Act. I'll make a motion to re-refer this to Ways and Means. Representative Mahoney, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1241, it's the Minnesota Call Center Act. We're seeing, with the globalization, we're seeing many call center jobs being outsourced, quite often overseas, more often than not overseas. This bill requires that when you have a call center with 50 employees or more, or 50 equivalent full-time employees, if a call center intends to relocate over 30% of its call volumes overseas, it's required to notify the Department of Employment and Economic Development at least 120 days in advance, or be penalized. It's a civil penalty up to $10,000 per day. That's the bill. We're just trying to save call center jobs in the state of Minnesota and in America. We're trying to make America great again.
Thank you, Chair Mahoney. I see you have Brad Leito from the AFL-CIO willing to chime in on the bill.
Thank you, Chair Sundin and Labor Committee members. My name is Brad Leto, Secretary Treasurer of the Minnesota AFL-CIO. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 1241. I'm also here on behalf of the thousands of Minnesota Communication Workers of America. CWA has been working to pass this bill in 2019 and has worked to pass similar bills in past legislative sessions. Call centers are an important economic lifeline for many communities in our state and across the country. With 57,240 call center workers, union and non-union, employed in the industry in our state alone. With thousands of call center workers across the country have lost their jobs in recent years as major corporations have offshored customer service operations overseas. This trend has harmed working families and communities in Minnesota and across America while endangering consumer security. An example, call centers in Costa Rica were home to a massive telemarketing scam that defrauded thousands of U.S. citizens, most over the age of 55, of upwards of $20 million. New provisions in the federal tax bill makes companies even more likely to move some jobs, customer service work overseas. According to the Joint Committee on Taxation, the new territorial tax system exempts offshore income from U.S. taxation, estimated because billions over the next decade. We should not be creating a tax incentive for corporations to move jobs offshore. We need new efforts that put Minnesota workers first, add new levels of accountability to the offshoring process, and ensure our taxpayer dollars are not rewarding companies who actively eliminate good jobs in our state. Good jobs for workers, men, and especially women in the call center industry, people of color, and those who represent almost every ethnic group in the state. And if you doubt this statement, I know CWA would set up a time for you to observe a call center. House File 1241, as mentioned before, ends grants, loans, tax benefits, and state contracts for companies that shift customer jobs out of the state or to a foreign country, and allows the state to claw back the outstanding value of taxpayer money or benefits the company received. House File 1241 provides legislators a great opportunity to do something tangible to demonstrate support for Minnesota workers. Please vote yes to move this legislation forward. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions to the author or the testifier? Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the author, 226 talks about the commissioner compiling a semi-annual list of all employers that are relocate. I would assume that the department is on track with doing that, and they've said that they have the capabilities of doing it without any additional cost.
Chair Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Vogel. They can either do it, yes, they're on board doing it. And if they want to come to me and say they need money, by the time they get their list ready to put it together, it's coming to my committee, they'll bring it up. But otherwise, they'll absorb it. They make lists all the time.
Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And it also says from the United States. Does that mean that they're going to have to compile it from the entire United States, or am I maybe reading something wrong?
Chair Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, I think they are seriously in overreach, and that might have to be taken care of, but we'll see what we can do. I'm not sure how that is going to play out, because making a list across the United States would entail interfacing with the Texas, Florida, North Carolina, wherever there may be one. This bill is being put forward in multiple different states. So I think the language is, what's the word? It's just a little ahead of its time just yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Vogel. Any other questions to the author or the testifier? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just a couple of things to the testifier. You said that this is an opportunity to do something tangible for workers. You know, for me personally, I think the tangible things that we can do is encourage businesses to staying in Minnesota by creating a better tax climate. I've seen the tax bill that the governor has put forth, and I don't see much tangible there for businesses. And so to the author of the bill, Representative Mahoney, I would say, why would a business choose to leave Minnesota? Why would they want to leave Minnesota? What feedback are you getting from them?
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Representative Fabian, the feedback that I get is that Minnesota has built a climate of, I'm not sure what the best word would be to use, but it is probably one of the four hardest states to get someone recruited out of. So if someone comes to work for one of our Fortune 500s, Target or General Mills or whatever, they will, 9 times out of 10, they will take a lower pay to stay in Minnesota or find a job with another corporation in Minnesota. So I have no understanding of why anyone would leave Minnesota. It never makes any sense to me. We have great schools. Most other states, if you're an executive or even a mid-level executive, you're sending your child to a private school. We have some of the best schools in the nation. Taxes are rarely the top of the list on most businesses when they really sit down and do an in-depth survey of reasons for why they have to leave the state of Minnesota. I guess once in a while you get a water issue when they have to leave the state of Minnesota, or not build in the state of Minnesota, but that's another story. So I don't agree with the premise, if the premise of your question is how come our tax climate scares all these businesses out. We gain as many businesses as we lose in a year. I think it's a false argument, but it's an argument that you get to make whenever you want.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it's not just taxes. It's taxes, it's regulations, it's just a general. Well, look what's happened with Line 3, how unfriendly Minnesota is to the Line 3 replacement.
To my heart,
well,
aren't you?
and Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, that is not unusual, okay? I have some awesome businesses, $17.25 an hour starting wage at Marvin Windows and Doors right now. I just saw the ad in the paper when I was home last weekend. You know, and I want to do things that encourage businesses to stay here. So when the businesses that were started by individuals, Minnesotans, with a dream, an idea to do something special, and there's a number of them up there that have, and when they have the good fortune to be able to grow and expand and increase their number of employees, why would they choose to operate in Grafton and Fargo instead of Crookston and Moorhead? I know why they do. They've told me why. They may not tell it to you, but we need to take steps in Minnesota to make Minnesota a more business-friendly place so we can put hard-hat union workers to work on pipelines and other places around the country, around the state.
I heard a question in there, and it was answered in there as well.
Thank you.
Any further questions to the author or the testifier from the committee? Are there any members of the public that wish to chime in on the bill? Hearing none, the motion again is to re-refer this bill to Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Okay.
So noted. Representative Mahoney, you have another bill, 2313.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Where is this bill going, Mr. Chair?
Excuse me. The motion is to re-refer to Ways and Means.
Ways and Means. This is a housekeeping bill from the Department of Labor and Industry, and it's technical. I'm going to let the technical guy explain it.
Thank you. You want to introduce yourself and welcome all technical questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Scott McClellan, an assistant director with the Department of Labor and Industry and also the state building official. We have, and thank you, Mr. Representative Mahoney, for sponsoring a bill, and thank you, committee members, for listening this morning. I have five housekeeping items. They may be technical, but not very complicated, but I'd be happy to answer any questions. So I'll briefly explain them as we walk through. Beginning at line 1.7, actually for the next several pages, the first item is currently requests for hearings to contest our notices of violation. Administrative orders and licensing orders must be mailed or faxed to the agency. So in order to be more efficient and current and up-to-date and now enable quicker due process, we want to change the statute to allow requests to be emailed as well. That'll keep things processing quickly. Beginning at line 420, which is a couple of pages in, we are proposing a grammatical change to the definition of public building. This corrects an error from several years ago when the term charter school was added to the subdivision, giving the department the responsibility for reviewing charter schools in addition to public school districts buildings. So this change will now make it clear that the definition applies to building projects for both public school districts and charter schools. If we didn't correct that and just left the terminology, bleachers and other ice rinks and other structures under that charter school would not get reviewed. So this aligns the definition. Beginning at line 4.25, we're proposing to repeal language shown in the appendix, which is on the last page of your bill. This is an outdated reference. Plumbing is a trade regulated by the Department of Labor and Industry, and currently this particular provision is an outlier that's placed in the Consumer Protection Products and Sales Statutes in 325F. So we're suggesting to delete all of that in 325F and then adding a new paragraph, which you see there, a new subdivision, to require the display of a plumbing contractor's license to be displayed on the vehicle of the licensed plumbing contractor. And this language is taken directly out of an identical requirement for electrical contractors that's in Minnesota rule. The next begins at line 5.1, and we're deleting some outdated language. There was a two-year phase-in for restricted plumbing licenses. That's now come and gone since 2011, so we're deleting that language. And then lastly, beginning at line 5.14 through the end, currently from time to time we get a question whether our agency can take action against an unlicensed residential building contractor, the same as we might with a licensed building contractor who violates licensing laws. So in order to correct that, we propose to add this language that it would enable the agency to take action on an unlicensed contractor that's doing work that's required to be licensed work. And those are the five pieces we are introducing this year, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for the author or the testifier? Nothing from the committee. Anyone in the public sector that would like to weigh in on the bill? Questions? Okay, seeing none, I'll renew the motion to re-refer this 2313 to Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members.
Okay. We'll move to House File 2000, Representative Lee and Company. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to present House File 2000. And before I present the bill, Mr. Chair, can you move it? And also, I have an author's amendment.
I'll move House File 2000. The motion is to refer to Ways and Means.
And then, Mr. Chair, thank you. I have the A19-0194 author's amendment.
I'll move that amendment, the A19. All in favor of the A19? Say aye.
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 Opposed? The bill's in the shape that you desire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Currently, when a state agency seeks bids from contractor for goods and services of at least $100,000, the agency cannot accept bids from contractors unless those contractors have a diversity hiring plan or affirmative action that has been approved by the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. This requirement applies only to contractors that have more than 40 full-time employees. This law has been on the books for a long time, and staff from the Department of Human Rights said that there are about 2,135 contractors in the state that currently have certificates of compliance with the Department of Human Rights that are good for 4 years. So my bill, as amended, will add equity goals to bonding projects and extends these requirement laws to cities, counties, and other entities that receive proceeds from general obligation bonds. And Mr. Chair, remember, this bill is important for Minnesota because it shows we value equity and will ensure workforce inclusion for our diverse communities when we make public infrastructure investment throughout the state. And I have Mr. Scott Patel here from the Department of Human Rights, too.
Please proceed and identify yourself.
Thank you, Chair Sundin and members of the committee. My name is Scott Patel. I'm the Public Policy Director of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. As Representative Lee said, House File 2000 would extend the existing workforce hiring goal requirements and equal pay certificate requirements to cover all bonding projects within the state of Minnesota. Currently, these programs cover bonding projects that are overseen by entities such as the Metropolitan Council, the Department of Administration, the Stadium Authority, which are generally covered by these programs regardless of funding source. But right now, for state-funded programs that are contracted by a non-covered entity, so generally cities, counties, maybe a port authority, that these hiring goals would not apply to their contractors. So this proposal would require that all these projects, if they meet that funding threshold of $100,000 or $500,000 for the equal pay certificates, would require that the contractor comply with these certificate requirements. And this helps to ensure that workforce inclusion opportunities exist when the state is funding these programs, and also ensure that the state's business partners are following existing equal pay laws. Just to be clear about the workforce certificate program, that's something where a little over 2,000 contractors within the state of Minnesota already are working with the department. In most cases, most of them have some state contracts, some non-state contracts. In doing research on this, we believe that of these contracts that are being done with bonding funds, nearly all of them are being done by contractors who are already certified by the department. So we cover a few more projects, but not that many more contractors. And so the primary duty, again, is on the contractor to make good faith efforts to recruit and hire women and people of color. So again, not quotas, it's a good faith effort standard for these. And then for the equal pay certificate of compliance, that was created by the legislature in 2014. And that just makes sure that women and men are being paid equally on these contracts. And so that does not create new legal obligations around equal pay. That just reinforces the existing equal pay laws for state for the state's business partners. So this bill recognizes the success that we've seen on a number of large state-funded projects like this capital that we're sitting in right now, where there were workforce goals. On that project, I believe 35% of the labor hours were done by people of color and 20% were done by women. And so there was this opportunity to, you know, help partner with an industry that has oftentimes has a labor shortage to diversify the group of folks that they're recruiting and hiring. And so this is an opportunity for the department and the state to help leverage this money that we're sending out to local communities to also work with contractors to help them diversify their workforces. We appreciate the committee hopefully moving this bill forward to help ensure that women, people of color, other individuals have opportunities to benefit from state funds on these projects. And we'd be happy to answer any questions you have. Thank you.
First up on the list is the chair. Coming from a union construction background, I recruit workers and we train workers. And in the union building trades, we actually boast about an excess of in over 30% diversity in our apprenticeship programs. Now, those apprentices and our journeymen that are available through through a hiring hall and several other hiring halls, that's a critical part of our workforce. But one contractor may not have satisfy that the goals, but the union that does supply men to that, or men and workers to that contractor from time to time, they do. So does that relationship with the unions that are in full compliance, in excess of compliance many times, how does that relationship feed into what you call good faith efforts by employers?
Thank you for that question, Mr. Chair. In terms of how the relationship between unions and the contractors, for the unionized contractors who are working on these state projects, most of them as part of their affirmative action plan would have elements about how they're going to work with their union to make these opportunities available. And we, of course, recognize that different unions have different kind of constraints and compositions, and that a workforce pool in Minneapolis is going to look different than a workforce pool in Baudette. And so the state hiring goals are different for those places. In terms of, you know, there's no specific legal duty on the unions themselves. The duty would be on the contractor, but for these, you know, the contractors that are unionized, which are many of the state's business partners, but clearly not all, they would work in partnership with them. And we've been really glad as a department to be able to partner with unions in kind of talking about labor force needs over time and seeing where there are opportunities where we can help be a good partner as a state entity in supporting some of those efforts. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I must say my concern is to protect the contractor that doesn't necessarily have enough people of diverse backgrounds or ethnicity to supply to satisfy the requirements on one job. But over in Winona, they might have that workforce going for them on a different project. So my concern is to protect the contractors on this. So. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Fabian. Oh, excuse me. Representative Detmer was first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know over the years we've been working on veteran preferences on some of these contracts and so forth. Does this still support veteran preferences?
To the testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Detmer. So currently the Department of Human Rights, the workforce inclusion part of the state's equity program, does not include veterans. It covers women, people of color, and then there's non-numerical goals for folks with disabilities. The state's programs for targeted group business and disadvantaged business enterprise, the TGB and the BBE programs that are administered by the Department of Administration and MnDOT, those have veterans preferences, and this wouldn't have any impact on those.
So what would it take, Mr. Chair, what would it take to include veterans' preferences in this piece of legislation?
To the testifier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, I'd be happy to sit down and have a conversation and get you together with Commissioner Lucero and have that discussion, if that would be helpful for you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Fabian,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciate your wanting to look out for contractors, I have a lot of concerns about that. Two, living in northwest Minnesota, you know, there's not populations of significant populations of minorities up there. You go to the state demographer's website. How does a small construction company that employs 43 people in Thief River Falls jump through these hoops to make sure that they're in compliance?
Mr. Butler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Fabian. So I think the key part in terms of looking at the kind of compliance standard for a contractor is that it's a good faith effort standard. And so a contractor needs to show that, you know, they're availing themselves of the resources in their community. And so if you're in Minneapolis, you know, you might say, I'm going to work with Summit OIC. If you're in, you know, a smaller town in rural Minnesota, you might also be saying that, you know, the reality of the demographics of our community is this is the labor force that's available to us. We've, you know, talked with our local union about who might be available. We've made some, you know, efforts to reach out to, you know, the local community or technical college. That might be part of a good faith effort. We've done advertising perhaps in Spanish language press in a community with, you know, with that. And that would be what you would go towards showing that you had made good faith efforts. And so we recognize and we definitely are not penalizing contractors if the reality of the, you know, labor force in that community just doesn't, you know, is not particularly diverse. That's not going to, you know, get you in trouble. So,
Representative Fabian.
Well, thank you. I appreciate hearing that, but I have to admit there's a healthy amount of skepticism in my area with regards to state government, and I'm not sure that gives me a whole lot of comfort in that the agency is going to be the one that gets to determine good faith. I'm sorry, I'm not on board with you. I wish that I was. And then we've also talked about union and non-union and so forth. The majority of contractors that I'm familiar with are non-union where I am. You've talked a lot about unions and what they do, and that's great. But how do we get back to, you know, the small construction companies that are non-union, that are providing really good jobs for folks, and they're not discriminating against anybody. They just need to get their work done during a very, very short construction season.
Mr. Butler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Fabian. I appreciate the comment about the large number of state contractors that aren't union. And, you know, we recognize that unions might just be one partnership that a contractor would avail themselves of, you know, in terms of trying to hire folks within their labor force. And I think one of the things we've heard in some communities, like, you know, say in Worthington, we've both heard folks saying, you know, we have this really diversifying community and we also have some labor shortages. And so looking at, you know, is there an opportunity to, you know, advertise to a, you know, a Spanish-speaking population in that area? Or is there an opportunity to, you know, work with local, you know, local business groups or local job training groups to achieve, you know, that, you know, those hiring goals? And so, you know, we recognize the challenges that sometimes exist, particularly in a seasonal, you know, seasonal construction situation. So, you know, we're cognizant of that in terms of kind of how this program is implemented and has been implemented. You know, it's not been a punitive thing. It's really been modeled on how can we support and work as a partner. And so we really always try to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quickly, a couple of things. I met yesterday with a contractor from northwest Minnesota. The number one problem they have right now is finding people to work. CDLs, heavy equipment operators, you know, all those sorts of things. And I don't want to create more obstacles for them to do that. But I am somewhat concerned about the language in the bill, and maybe Mr. Weeks can help me out here. We're going to be hearing House File 2001 later on this evening. And we're hearing 2000 now, and as I understand the amendment that's coming on 2001, we're actually in that bill on line 2.19 and 2.20, we're taking out section 16A.695, and in this bill, we're putting it in. If I had a teacher from Roseville, I'm confused. Help me out. Somebody.
Mr. Weeks, do you have input on this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, so I was looking at 16A.695, and I think my understanding is correct, and the representative from the Department of Human Rights can correct me if I'm wrong. I believe the intent is just to pull in the definition of public officer or agency subject from 16A.695, which would then be University of Minnesota, Minnesota Historical Society, or any county home rule charter or statutory city, school district, special purpose district, basically any local government plus the University of Minnesota and Minnesota Hospital. And so I think it's possible that there could be a clarifying change that that definition is included in here instead of the reference, especially if 16A.695 is going to go away in a different bill.
Representative Fabian?
Yeah, I'm curious. I see that.
Mr. Buell.
Mr. Buell wants to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian. So I have to apologize. In the drafting of the amendment for 2001, we got our wires a little bit crossed with the reviser, and they grabbed a piece of language from that was supposed to be in the House File 2000, and it wound up in House File 2001. So that's the reason why in the amendment that gets deleted in House File 2001, which is a purely technical bill, because we just happened to get our wires a little crossed with the reviser's office. So that's deleting any reference to the public officer section of statute that's here that does sort of expand the scope of the program to cover these bonding projects. So my apologies for that. That was my failure of communication, and we're getting a little bit of drafting hiccups sorted out. So thank you.
Okay. Any follow-up, Representative Fabian?
I'm not sure.
I'm confident this will all be resolved by 7 o'clock tonight. Thank you. I have another concern in relationship to tarot workers on reservations. We have several Native American reserves in the state of Minnesota, and what's your relationship with the tribes, and does this affect the taro ratios on construction projects?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It would not have an impact on that. These goals, as they're written, don't apply to those projects, as I understand.
Thank you. I'll take your word for it for now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions to the testifier or the author?
Mr. Chair, is the agency going to be here to testify this evening, too?
Mr. Buell.
I'm curious to know where these bills are coming from. Are these agency bills, 2000 and 2001, Representative Lee?
Mr. Chair, this is an agency bill, yes.
I'm sorry, what?
This is an agency bill, yes.
They're both agency bills, Mr. Chair?
That's my understanding.
Okay.
Mr. Buell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, they are both agency bills. Thank you.
There's an E and one. Yeah, so I'm sorry, I'm just really confused on this. In House File, in the amendment, in 2000, you have subdivision E, page 2.10 to 2.12, but you don't have it in...
Must they take it out in the amendment?
Is it gone in the amendment in 2001?
Representative Fabian, we could lay this over. I could change the motion, lay this over, and take a look at it tonight. Or
I just want to be sure that we're clear what we're doing.
Certainly,
because I'm not trying to muck anything up for anybody. I just want to make sure that our I's are dotted and our T's are crossed.
Thank you, Representative Fabian. Mr. Buell, any input?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Fabian. So for the amendment to 2001, the change that's being made in the statute consolidates within 363A36 subdivision 1. It consolidates paragraph A and paragraph B into one paragraph. Working with the reviser and working with the Department of Administration and trying to create some clarifying language, they felt that the best way forward was to consolidate those two paragraphs. And they're aware that we have these two bills on this same section of statute moving at once, and the revisers told us that this wouldn't be a problem. But that's the reason why within the 2001 you wind up with one fewer paragraphs, because that A and B are consolidated, and then they renumber the rest of the section.
Representative Fabian.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you. I know this is deadline week and so forth. I don't know if this counts as having a hearing on the bill, if it's been heard someplace else. Have the bills been heard in other committees?
Representative Lee.
Mr. Chair, this is the first committee stop. All
right. Thank you. So, Representative Fabian.
Do what you need to do to get things cleaned up, and I don't know if we need to come back this evening to do this, if we could do it another time and still meet the deadline. It's up to you.
I think we'd like to advance the bill tonight and if there's some work to be done on that, I trust the department will be diligent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fabian.
You do know there's a state basketball game tonight, right?
Representative Fabian, I'm a hockey fan. Okay. Any further questions?
Girls and all that, too.
Yes. Any further questions to the testifier or the author? Okay, I'll renew the motion to refer this bill to Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, you're on your way. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, what do we got? Ma'am? Oh, okay, great. Next up, we have House File 557, Representative Mann. I'll make the motion to re-refer this to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division. Representative Mann, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. Today I'm talking about 557, which would restrict non-compete agreements in physician contracts. So what's currently happening is that most physicians, in their contracts, there's something called a non-compete clause. And it says that when your employment ends at a clinic or a hospital, you are not allowed to practice within a, pick a number, mile radius, from the previous employment. So if a provider, for whatever reason, wants to leave their current practice, they have to sometimes relocate their entire families in order to continue practicing medicine, even if the clinic down the street is hiring. The biggest issue with this is that now, all of the patients that physician was seeing, all those people have to find a new physician. So we're putting in a really big barrier to patient care, and we're breaking up the physician-doctor relationship, which we know has significant healthcare outcomes. This clause is a direct barrier to good patient care and continuity of care. It is one of the contractual clauses that is solely for the benefit of the organization and not in the best interest of the patient or the physician. There are many, many barriers to care, and this does not have to be one of them. With that, I would like to call up my first testifier, Mr. Dave Racer.
Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dave Racer. I am from St. Paul, District 67A. Saw my member here just a few minutes ago. I'm a member of the board of the Minnesota Physician Patient Alliance. I'm a member of the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters Legislative Committee. I am the Executive Director of Minnesota Employers and Employees Demanding Affordable Health Care. I have written 19 books on health care and speak across the country on the issue. One of my books, which is now 2 years old, is called Passion for Patients. You can tell by the title that our primary objective is to establish a healthcare system that puts patients first. And anything that tends to get in the way gets our attention. The thing that we're dealing with here, of course, is contract law, which is fairly sacred some ways, but then I also understand that the legislature has the ability to change contract law, and so I think that's what we're talking about here. I notice in Section 1, Subdivision 1, four purposes, continuity of care, protect the physician-patient relationship, increase access to care, and then it says the right of physicians to practice medicine. If I could amend that, which I can't, I would say the right of patients to see the physician of their choice. This is one of the complications that the non-compete presents, that I as a patient am going to lose contact with my physician, even though he or she may be moving a couple blocks away from where I've been seeing them for a period of time. And so I urge you to consider first and foremost, the patient's need for continuity of care. That goes to physical and mental health and financial health, I'm sure, and touches many, many other areas of the physician's or the patient's relationship with the doctor and with their own health. So I urge your support for this Bill 557.
Representative Mann.
Mr. Chair, was there an amendment? Did you receive that?
Is there an amendment? Okay, we do have one amendment, and there it is. Can you explain the amendment, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It just sets the date so that this would go into effect once the law passes and not be retroactive.
Okay, I'll move adoption of the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? There we have a bill in the shape that you prefer. Do you have other testifiers?
No.
Okay. Any questions, too? Any testifiers from the public sector? Please identify yourself and proceed.
That's great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. Our membership is comprised of 141 hospitals and healthcare systems. We represent both large hospitals. We have one member that has over 2,000 beds. And we also have 78 critical access hospitals that have less than 25 beds. And we have several hospitals that have less than 10 beds. In the last couple of weeks, I have learned a great deal about the term physician non-compete contracts, and I realize they mean different things to different hospitals. This bill has caused a great deal of concern to hospitals, both large and small, in part because the term non-compete contract is actually not found anywhere in statute. So this bill prohibits a type of contract that means different things to different organizations. Many hospitals, particularly rural hospitals, pay for medical school, loan forgiveness, signing bonuses, and relocation expenses to recruit a physician to come to their community. Basically, what it is the hospital agrees to pay for medical school, and the new physician agrees to come and work exclusively for that hospital for maybe a 4 to 5 year period. So is that a standard contract, or is that considered a non-compete contract? I believe the author of the bill, as well as others, do not really consider that type of contract a non-compete contract. The problem for us is it's not defined anywhere. And so that causes many of our members to have anxiety about what exactly is a non-compete contract. Like I said, this is standard practice throughout rural Minnesota to pay for medical school in order to recruit a doctor to come to their community. If non-compete contracts are narrower in scope, what do they entail? Are they about leaving employment and then being prohibited from going to work for a competitor or starting a competing practice? So is this bill trying to say that if a hospital purchases a clinic and gets a highly trained specialist to come to that community, and then they have access historically to the patients of that hospital, and the hospital helps them build their practice, maybe purchasing equipment, getting them set up in a new clinic, that then that physician could, after the hospital has helped them set up their practice, they could decide to set up a clinic across the street that they would own rather than the hospital. So basically, they would be leaving the hospital with an empty clinic and perhaps no patients. Shouldn't the hospital be allowed to have some type of contract relationship with that physician for some period of time, or can they be free to go and compete with the hospital? Several states have compromise laws that allow physicians to have some type of non-compete contract, but with parameters. So let me just give you two examples. So in Tennessee, physicians and hospitals have like a 2-year non-compete contract that prohibits the physician from working within that county. Now, that's a pretty broad non-compete. Other states have more narrow non-competes, like the state of Connecticut. It says that a hospital and a physician can have a 1-year non-compete contract and that the physician could not set up an independent practice within a 15-mile radius of the hospital. So there are examples of around the country of limited non-compete contracts. But House File 557 prohibits any type of non-compete contract. And so our hospitals, is it just, are they concerned about, is it the first type that is standardly used as a routine method of recruiting physicians to rural communities, or is it just about the second type? And we're really pleased to hear today that this bill was sent to the Judiciary Committee, because this is substantial change to contract law. We're hoping that we can work with the author of the bill and maybe get some clarifications around this language. Is she trying to prevent any type of contract that says that a hospital and a doctor could not reach an agreement about paying for their college or medical school? Or is this just about this practice parameter if they leave employment? So we're really looking for some clarification. And is there a compromise around the length of a non-compete contract and the distance? So with that, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Krinke. I see in the testifier list of Cindy Firkins, Dr. Firkins.
Pretty close.
Okay. Please identify yourself correctly then and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Sundin. For the record, my name is Dr. Cindy Firkins-Smith. I'm CEO of Caris Health, based in Wilmer, Minnesota, serving West Central and Southwest Minnesota. We're part of the CentraCare Health family, and we share a common purpose and passion for serving rural Minnesotans. I am also a dermatologist, and I've served patients in rural Minnesota for nearly three decades. When I joined what was then Affiliated Community Medical Centers 28 years ago, I signed a non-compete clause as part of my contract, and that non-compete remains in place today. I appreciate the opportunity to come before this committee today to discuss this issue, which is more complex than it seems. That complexity is rooted in part in our geography. As many on this committee know, serving the healthcare needs of rural Minnesota presents unique challenges that can be hard to translate here in St. Paul. My purpose for being here today is to impress upon each of you the efforts, responsibilities, and investments inherent in the role of providing access to rural Minnesotans. Non-compete agreements are an important tool in building the sustainable infrastructure necessary to serve rural Minnesotans' need for quality care. Just as important in understanding what I'm advocating for today is understanding what I'm not advocating for. By asking this committee to consider a uniquely rural perspective, I'm not asking you for permission to apply any leverage. Leveraging doesn't work, and it isn't fair. And I'm advocating today for fairness. The essence of a contract is a bargain for exchange, and a significant part of the benefit of that bargain is knowledge that the investments we are making today will ensure a sustainable model for access to healthcare and to physicians in the future. I want to be specific, so please allow me to share a brief narrative of what it's like and what it takes to successfully recruit rural providers to rural Minnesota. Recruiting physicians and healthcare providers is, without a doubt, one of our biggest challenges. We are currently recruiting physicians in nearly every specialty. We can invest years and tens of thousands of dollars in recruitment costs for each physician we recruit. If and when we're fortunate and that physician joins our community, the costs of signing bonus, moving expenses, credentialing, hiring staff, and supporting that physician's salary and expenses while he or she builds a practice often requires an investment of over $1 million. To compete for some specialists in rural practices, we are now paying signing bonuses alone of over $100,000. In rural Minnesota, we take care of many Medicare and Medicaid patients, and as you're well aware, the reimbursement for caring for these patients often does not cover the costs of their care. We depend on our entire family of physicians to support our mission to take care of all of our patients and use positive operating margins on some services to help us offset other services needed in our communities, like mental health and primary care. If our group dedicates $1 million to support an orthopedic surgeon, for example, and after building a practice, he or she decides they can take that practice and those patients that we helped build and paid for to build across the street and do better on their own, we will not long survive. And if we do not survive, there will be no one to care for all of the needs of all of the patients that we serve. And that's the world of rural health. It's a very different world than that in a densely urban area where the choices are many. We need non-compete clauses as a matter of fairness and as a matter of survival. I thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Dr. Firkins-Smith. Appreciate your input. Is there any other testifiers? Any input from the public other than two that we've heard from? Okay, questions to the testifiers or the author? Representative Brand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the doctor that's just testified, just out of curiosity, just what's the average wages for a rural doctor in Willmar?
Depends on the specialty.
Okay. But just in general.
I would say for a family physician, it's going to depend on their how productive they are and how many hours per week they work, but in the range of $200,000 to $400,000. For an orthopedic surgeon, depending on how hard they work, $600,000 to $750,000. It seems counterintuitive, but we often have to pay physicians in rural Minnesota more than they make in urban areas.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for the testifiers or the author? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Perkins-Smith, thank you for what you do and to the author, too, for that matter. I talked to the CEO at the hospital in Roseau about this a little bit, and I'm not sure to the author of the bill. And I apologize, I wasn't here for most of your introduction. I was out talking about House File 2000-2001. What problem are we solving?
Representative Mann.
Mr. Chair. So a couple issues. One is that we're prohibiting people from practicing where they want. Two is, and the most important issue, is that once a physician doesn't want to work at a certain place anymore and they want to move across the street to a different organization or to their own, we are essentially breaking all of that, their patients, we're going to break all of those physician-patient relationships. And we know that continuity of care is one of the biggest things that provide good health care outcomes, is continuity of care. People who have a physician that they trust and have seen for years, they have better health care outcomes. And so this clause it breaks up that relationship. And like many clauses in contracts, in physician contracts, it is not for the benefit of the patient. It is not for the benefit of this physician. It is for the bottom line of the hospital. And also, and I feel like I'm having a little deja vu here, is we talked about this last time, and that the things that Ms. Krinke talked about, none of that applies to this bill. So when a physician is recruited to work in a rural hospital, and I worked in a rural hospital for many years, town of 1,000 people, they provide you with lots of things. They can provide you with a signing bonus, moving expenses, everything you mentioned, or retention bonus. And those things they're completely separate than the non-compete portion of the contract. So if I get a signing bonus, that it'll say in my contract, you will get the signing bonus, but you have to work here for 5 years. And if you leave here before those 5 years is up, you have to pay back the signing bonus. That is a completely separate issue than if I want to leave at year 3, I will pay back my signing bonus, but I get to practice wherever I want, and my patients can continue to see me. If I'm an orthopedic surgeon, like the example that you used, and I want to go across the street, I am not going to build a new hospital and operating room across the street. I might see patients across the street, but I will continue likely to use the hospital's OR room and the hospital's equipment. And again, that is a completely separate issue. If you hire me and I'm your surgeon and you say I'm going to invest this much money in your operating equipment, but that means you have to stay here for X amount of years, great. If you leave early, you pay that money back, but I can go practice wherever I want and my patients can continue to see me. So the things that they're bringing up are very important, but completely separate than what this bill is trying to do.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, in Roseau and Thief River Falls, you can't move across the street because there's no facility across the street. It's 65 miles from Roseau to Thief River Falls. And in terms of continuity of care, I don't see how that's possible because in Roseau County, we only have one insurance provider. And in Pennington County, at the next nearest hospital, we don't have that same provider. So how do we look out for the patient in that situation and have a continuity of care? Listen, I would like to have doctors work wherever they want. I get that. But if for me and the district that I represent, if this is truly about patients, you know, it's not going to, I don't see how it's going to work. And especially if there's no definition for a non-compete in statute, we just change the verbiage in a contract and it becomes the same thing as I see it. I'm not a lawyer, but maybe Mr. Weeks can help me on a non-compete. If there's no definition of that, I mean, do we just change the terminology in a contract and accomplish the same thing?
Chair Sundin, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Weeks.
Sorry, Chair. Subdivision 2 lays out specifically what's disallowed. It uses the term non-compete in the subdivision header, but then it talks about the specific terms of the agreement that would be disallowed. So you're correct that non-compete's not defined in statute, but I think all the language in there defines what would be disallowed under this bill.
Representative Fabian.
So Mr. Chair, yeah. So then here, I just see a move into courts and let the courts decide what the definition is. But I appreciate what you're doing, what you feel you're doing, but boy, for rural Minnesota, I just see a lot of problems with this.
Dr. Ferkin-Smith.
Thank you. If I could respond just a second, I understand the comments you made. From an orthopedic surgery standpoint, they actually can go across the street. Much of care now is being performed in outpatient facilities. And one of the reasons an orthopedic surgeon might choose to desert a hospital is because he or she can work with an investor, build a surgery center, and make considerable profit on their own. And so there's pretty strong incentive, actually, to leave a hospital. And as I stated, one of the reasons it's important, and as you point out, we're using those shared resources to serve all of the needs for all of our patients in rural Minnesota.
Thank you, Doctor. Any other questions? Representative Purcell.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and I didn't have anything to say until you just said what you said, and isn't that capitalism?
It is, but I'm dedicated to the care. I apologize, Chair, Chairman. Should I?
Oh, go ahead, Doctor.
You're exactly right. It is capitalism, but my mission is to take care of people, and so I work very hard to make sure that we have the resources to do that. Out in West Central and Southwestern Minnesota, frankly, our patients are poor, and a lot of them are reimbursed by Medicaid and Medicare. And if we didn't have non-competes and every physician could set up shop after we built their practice and take all of the monies that we invested, we wouldn't be able to take care of the people that we're dedicated to serving. That's just the honest truth.
Mr. Chair, that sounds a little bit like socialized medicine to me. That we're
to me, it sounds like just trying to take care of the people that I serve every day.
Understood.
Thank you, Representative Purcell.
Mr. Chair, and I think we should take care of everybody, but we're either going to be free enterprise or we aren't going to be free enterprise with regard to medicine. And I see this as problematic to not being free enterprise.
As they say, it's Dr. very Ferguson. Complicated.
Thank you. Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair, I think we have another testifier.
We have another testifier. I'm sorry. Thanks.
He's hiding behind the post over there, I think. Yeah. You.
Please identify yourself and proceed.
Santa Cruz on behalf of Centric Care Health. I just wanted to highlight two points. One, I think Representative Fabian said it very well in terms of without a clear definition, and I have reviewed the bill, in statute or well established, we look at a lot of litigation around a lot of contracts. It's hard to predict things, but I'm sure of that. There will be many, many times where certain lawyers will anticipate that the type of contracts that Ms. Krinke was describing would fit within that definition. And then on the flip side, for folks who say, well, you know, I can't pay that back or I won't pay that back, is the hospital or the practice group going to have to sue to do that, in which case, where does that practice go? Well, that litigation goes on to collect on that promissory note. So without some clarity, I would just suggest to this committee and Mr. Chair and members with respect to particularly rural Minnesota, both CentraCare and Caris have a relationship, and I have worked on a number of these contracts. It really is a bargain for exchange. When you show up to the doorstep of a health system, you come with a portfolio of services, but what the health system brings forth is access to many patients and many resources in terms of building that practice and making that practice a success, not just for that individual, but for the community at large. And I think that Representative Fabian's points are well taken, well thought of, and should be considered very seriously by this community.
Response to that?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, again, whether we call it a non-compete or anything else, what it is very well defined and quite clear in the bill. And, again, it has nothing to do with reimbursing people for recruitment and signing bonuses and things of that nature. All it says is that when that relationship is done, the physician can go somewhere else. And in rural practice, what is happening is that if a physician has a non-compete and they leave that practice, they have to leave the town. So we're talking about trying to retain physicians in rural areas, but this goes exactly against that because now the physician can't even stay in that rural town. They have to go to the town next door or further in order to practice. So it's kind of the opposite of what's being said.
Thank you. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Mann. You know, the non-compete, non-solicitation is a long-time practice in employment of different professionals. Should all them be treated the same? In other words, I understand the relationship between a doctor and a patient, but there's also a significant relationship between an attorney and their client, a CPA and their client, a financial professional and their client. So it's not at all uncommon when you get into professional relationships to have these because of some of the things that were noted here. You're looking at changing one thing. The question is, why then aren't you going to change the whole gamut because you're messing with long-precedented law?
Representative Mann.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, so I can't speak to lawyers' relationships or CPA relationship, but I can tell you that once a physician leaves and that patient has to start over, all of a sudden our health care costs go up because they have to start all over. They have to redo tests. They have to retry medicine sometimes when the doctor doesn't like the medicine that they're on. So, again, I can't speak to those particular relationships, but I can tell you that this relationship is a big deal, not only for people, but for economics.
Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, but the question was that, yes, these professionals are important to whoever their client are, and I would hope that you would agree that an attorney, that there's a professional relationship there that's important to the client. And that was the question, is we're signaling out the medical profession, and I can understand what you just said and agree with that, but this is a long-running practice in the professional service area. So my question is, why are you singling out just the medical community? I understand your point there, but we're changing the way that non-competes, non-solicitations are being done, and there's a long precedent of legal cases with that, and that's the reason for the question, not because of the type of service, but because of the nature of what you're talking about changing.
Representative Mann.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so just because something's been in place for a long time doesn't make it right? And again, I can't speak to those other relationships or those other contracts because I don't know enough about them.
Thank you. Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Got a few more.
Sure.
Okay. As I said, there's been lots of precedent here, and you're making it sound as if you can't perform your career. And one of the things that's peculiar to this part of the code and the precedent is that you can't put something in a non-compete, non-solicitation that provides that eliminates somebody from being able to make a living. So, and I'm talking about the providers. I understand we talked about clients as well, but in what you're doing here is you're looking to not allow somebody to enter into a contract of their free will. Now, as far as inducement and pain to that provider, there's a long court precedent of what can be done and what can't be done. In other words, you can't not allow somebody to practice over the entire state. You might get away with 10 miles in 1 year or something like that. So this isn't where they're going to be forced into something that is going to harm them for life. So the question is, since it's doing that, and the providers are entering this of their free will because they are being compensated for it, because that's the other thing with a non-compete, non-solicitation. If you're not compensated, it's not enforceable. So therefore, it's a two-way bargain here between the provider and between the employer. So what you're doing then is, the question is, why would you want to take away the right of the provider to bargain for something that will benefit them?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mann.
Representative, so that's not what's happening here, right? Because what can happen is a physician wants to work somewhere, and I've known this to happen many times, and that they say you have to sign this non-compete. And the non-compete is not just 10 miles. It can be 30 miles. And it cannot be for 1 year. It can be for 3 years. And they say, no, unless you sign it, we're not giving you the job. So it's not a free will, oh, we're just negotiating this contract, no big deal. It has prevented physicians from getting the jobs that they want and working in the areas that they want. And even if it is for 1 year, is that physician going to commute over an hour, 2 hours to get to work? Or are they going to move their whole families? Or are they just not going to have a paycheck for 1 year?
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Mann, non-competes are not enforceable unless there was consideration passed from one party to the other party that would be considered fair and equitable. The physician would not be able, that hospital, that employer would not be able to enforce this contract if it goes to court and it's deemed that the physician was taken advantage of because they were given $2 not to practice for 3 years. The concept here of getting capital investment. I come out of medical school. I want to set up a practice, especially a highly intensive capitalized practice like that was being talked about, orthopedics or whatever. I need a client list because I have to feed my family right away. You're taking away the employment freedom of those providers, and by the same token, you're limiting the market because you're not allowing different employers to bid on those people because they're going to sign an agreement that's fair and equitable or it won't be enforceable. So the question is, how can you take away the right of somebody that has graduated from medical school or is a practicing physician to enter into a bargain with an employer, because you're taking away one of the things that they can use as their bargaining chip to get something they need to be able to provide services?
Representative Mann, and I'm going to remind everybody, my intention is to vote on this in about 8 minutes, and we have four other people lined up with questions. So can we be brisk?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I completely disagree with what you're saying. We're not taking away choice at all. In fact, we're adding choices for physicians. It's that simple.
Well, Mr. Chair, one more. I'm sorry.
Please.
But we've got two physicians up there. Would it be okay if either one of them might just make a short comment as far as they're actually the people that are practicing, they're the people that have entered into these agreements? Would it be okay to ask one of them to just make a short comment as to whether or not?
Short could be described as 30 seconds.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members, I was not smart enough to get into law school, but I am a lawyer. And so I appreciate the promotion to MD, but I do feel comfortable speaking on this because this is a legal document. This is not a question about medical practice. This is a question about the practice of law. And I think that I personally and CentraCare and I think Karis, if this bill could be laid at the table, would like to work with this particular bill to clarify some of the things that the author said in the record were part of the bill, but are not actually in the text of the bill. And in the law, with lawyers, we like to see it on the page. And
that's
so we
not the motion. I'll remind the testifier and the author, that's not the motion before us today. So.
But to the Mr. Chair and members, to that extent, if we can work with this author about clarifying some of the things that she has said are part of this bill but are not actually in the language of this bill, as an attorney, that would make me much more comfortable.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Dr. Ferkin-Smith.
Well, you asked about entering into an agreement with the non-compete and how I felt about it, basically. 30 years ago, that was the standard. It remains the standard out where we are. I expected to enter into non-compete. I knew that I was doing that with my own free will. I actually signed another non-compete when we entered into Caris, and each time there was consideration for it. I think it's reasonable. I think it's important in order to sustain the practice.
Thank you. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think Representative Vogel did an outstanding job asking the question that I was going to ask. The second part of my question was, how big of a problem is this really? Is this something that we really have to be looking at in the legislature?
Representative Mann.
Mr. Chair, so it is a problem because, again, we have so many things that keep people from being healthy. We have so many barriers to good care in this country, and this is just an added one. Now, above the barriers that patients already face, we're going to take away their physicians. I mean, this bill is a very, very small piece of the big healthcare picture. And this bill puts patients at the top of the list. This is about keeping their patients with their doctors. This is not about the bottom line of big hospital organizations. This is not about the bottom line of insurance companies and all the big players in healthcare that make all the money. This is about the patient. And we have too little of that these days. So, yeah, this is a big deal.
Thank you. Just a reminder that most of the legal concerns regarding this bill will be addressed in the Judiciary Committee. So thanks for all the questions, but they'll probably be better answered in the next committee stop. Actually, Representative Brand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of quick follow-up questions in particular. What would be the remedy if you have entered into a non-compete agreement with a doctor and they turn out to be a bad doctor? Can you fire them on the spot? Is it still at will? And does it remove that what we're talking about today?
If a physician is taking poor care of patients, oh, yes. You can't keep that physician whether or not they signed a non-compete or not.
And then does that dissolve that non-compete?
Dr. Ferkin-Smith.
It generally does not, depending on the circumstances. They also are not required to pay back any of the investment.
Okay. Well, what happens?
Thank you, Representative Brand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What happens if they get hit by a bus? How does the hospital take care of that situation?
Dr. Ferkin-Smith.
Because you've made a significant investment in that physician and now they're dead.
Dr. Ferkin-Smith.
Thank you for that question, Representative Brand. I'm a little bit taken aback because that's not happened to us. Then we would grieve. All of the benefits would go to that physician's family. There would be no payback. That's a totally different consideration. A physician dies. They can't control that.
Okay. So you would just absorb that last
question. Brand.
Of course.
Okay. All right. And the last question I have is more of a general question. So if somebody is moving from a hospital to a private practice within the community and it's in the rural area, I guess my question is, does the community get slighted, or is that a benefit to the community to have two options instead of one?
Dr. Ferkin-Smith.
So, if there's a physician in the community, it's generally a benefit. If the physician wants to come to the community and join the private practice, we're all thrilled. We're thrilled to get every physician and every specialty that comes to our community. The issue for us is when we support the physician and build the practice, most physicians aren't coming out on their own and building practices because the investment is too significant. And so when we have to invest scores of money to build practices for physicians, if they want to go out on their own, we as an organization wouldn't survive very long and wouldn't be able to sustain the health care for the community.
Thank you, Doctor. Moving on to Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think this bill really highlights the problems with our health care system, that we value profit over actual care of people. One of the questions that came to my mind when Mr. Cruz, when you talked about a successful practice, I wonder what in your mind is a successful practice. I assume that it's a profitable practice. And so when I think about how insurance companies work, it usually is, hospitals and insurance companies are different. I understand that. But insurance companies, you know, if the least amount of claims that they pay out, the more profit they make. When that comes to healthcare, that's not actually healthcare. And so that, and then I was also thinking about, when Representative Vogel talked about fair and equitable contracts and entering into them, and then Representative Fabian talked about the fact that a lot of your communities only have one provider. So if I want to move to Roseau and I, you know, that's the community. What was that? Well, and that's the community I fall in love with. I want to move there, and it's, you know, the nature around there, but there's only one provider. What choice do I have? And a lot of these providers have teams of lawyers that can kind of strong-arm you into a contract. I see this as something that if we want to make sure that we have good doctors and our communities, this kind of brings up a bigger conversation. So I apologize.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair,
I believe I've asked a question. For a response here and 15 seconds okay. for
Mr.
response.
Mr. Chair here. And members, ahead, to respond to the question, what defines success for a health system? We don't have shareholders. We're a non-for-profit, as is Caris. There are for-profit providers. They typically come in the specialty groups that we've been discussing, like orthopedics. So I thank you for making our point for us so well.
Thank you, Mr. Cruz. Dr. Firkin-Smith.
And that I just wanted to point that's why this is so very complicated. Our goal is to keep physicians practicing. Our goal is to maintain health care for our communities. We are not for profit. We don't want a physician to stay in order to make a profit. We want a physician to stay in order to sustain the entire health care delivery system. It's not just orthopedics that we're taking care of. We're trying to take care of mental health, primary care, pediatrics, all of those issues.
Thank you. The hour has come, but Representative Vogel has...
Mr. Chair, request a roll call, please.
Certainly, a roll call is requested. It will be performed. Okay. Thank you, everyone, for your input on this. The motion, I will renew the motion to re-refer this 557 to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division. We'll take the roll.
Representative Sundin.
Aye.
Representative Cagle.
Yes.
Representative Vogel.
No.
Representative Brand.
Aye.
Representative Claflin.
Yes.
Representative Detmer.
No.
Representative Eklund.
Yes.
Representative Fabian.
No.
Representative Hornstein.
Yes.
Representative Lippert.
Aye.
Representative Mecklen.
No.
Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Representative Purcell.
Aye.
The motion passes 9-4. Okay, we've got a bill. Another bill.
Recess. Here. Representative Sundin, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 2311. All provisions of this bill were approved by the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council, a group created by statute comprising 6 members from the organized labor and 6 from business. The WCAC reviews and recommends changes to Minnesota Workman's Compensation Laws, Minnesota Statutes Section 176.1812 allows an employer or groups of employers and unions to bargain for certain obligations and procedures relating to workers' compensation. Examples include an agreement on a list of approved medical providers, creation of an alternative dispute resolution system, and creation of a light duty or modified job program. The Union Construction Workers Compensation Program administers one such program for a group of employers and unions who have bargained, excuse me, for these obligations and procedures. We have a department with me today to explain 2311.
Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Laura Zajac. I'm an attorney at the Department of Labor and Industry. Thank you for the opportunity to testify briefly today. The proposed legislation would streamline the exchange of information between the Union Construction Workers' Compensation Program and the Department of Labor and Industry. The proposed legislation includes two key concepts. The first is the elimination of employer approval by the department. Historically, when an employer joined the Union Construction Workers' Compensation Program, the program would send the commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry a letter, and then the commissioner would then send back a letter approving the employer. Approval process may have had some value in the past when it was limited to construction contractors, but now the program is open to all employers, so there's no discretion in the law for the commissioner to administer. What we're proposing is that instead of this formal approval process, there'd just be a notification requirement, 30 days for the program to notify the department when an employer is either joining or leaving the program. The second concept in the bill before you today relates to the exchange of claim-specific workers' compensation data between the department and the program. Under current law, the program is required to provide an annual report to the department, which contains aggregate data about the workers' compensation claims that it covers. The aggregate data does not allow the department to identify individual claims. The changes in this bill would require payers of workers' compensation benefits to indicate to the department which claims are covered by the program when they report the claims. Under the legislation, the annual report would still exist but be limited only to claim-specific dispute data, which would not otherwise be in the department's control. These changes benefit both the department and the program. Knowing which individual claims are subject to the program will be valuable to the department for customer assistance and research and statistics. It will let us manipulate the data, make comparisons between claims in and outside the program, and we'll have access to more real-time, robust information. And in exchange, the program will also have a lessened reporting burden because we'll have that information at our fingertips. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about the language. We also have today Kevin Gregerson, the director of the Union Workers' Compensation Construction Program, here today to support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Would you state your name for the record and continue with your testimony?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kevin Gregerson. I am the administrator of the Union Construction Workers' Compensation Program and have been since its inception in 1997. The program is comprised of about 365 union contractors in Minnesota, employing 23,500 union tradespeople who are represented by 14 different trade unions throughout the state. We support the bill. It will simplify the process that we go through to report information to the department. It also gives the department the ability to access data on individual claims that they don't currently have. Thank you.
Are there any member questions? None? Final word, Representative Sundin?
Thank you. This is a good bill. Vote yes. And if you ever have any workman's comp issues, take them to the latest member of the Workman's Comp Advisory Board, yours truly.
With that, would you like to renew your motion to re-refer to Ways and Means?
That's the motion. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. And that is the, we are in recess now until 7 p.m., and it looks like that will be in room 10 of the state office building.
Thank you, everyone, for giving up another evening to do the state's important business here. So we have before us House File 2001. And I'll move the House File 2001 to be referred to Ways and Means. Representative Cantrell, explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I sincerely appreciate the opportunity to bring this bill before you today. House File 2001 essentially makes existing statute as it pertains to workforce certificates of compliance. It brings this existing statute in line with in a manner that is more concise and I think clears up a little bit of the difficulty and kind of interpretation that's been expressed by the Office of Administration. So with me today is Mr. Butel. Did I get that right? Okay, good. And he is from the Department of Human Rights, and he'll go into a little bit of detail, not only about this bill and the changes that we are making, and I do want to underscore, too, that this isn't going to really change anything except make the existing language more concise, and he'll also be here to help clear up any consternation that may arise. So I appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chair, and I'll turn the presentation over to Mr. Butel.
Mr. Butel, please be very, very thorough as we are waiting for an amendment to the amendment to appear in the room. So please be very thorough with your testimony. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I can be very, very, very thorough as we wait for this amendment. So my name is Scott Butel. I'm the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. Thank you for hearing this second agency bill of the day. We appreciate the committee's time. So basically what this bill does is it clarifies some language within the Workforce Certificate of Compliance Statute, which is Minnesota Statute 363A-36. This is an existing program that is administered by the Department of Human Rights. The Department of Human Rights and the Department of Administration work closely in this area on an ongoing basis with the Department of Administration's work that they conduct around procurement for the state. And Julie Byrell, who's the Legislative Director for Department of Administration, is here if there's any questions for them. And so in discussions with Department of Administration, we've identified this specific section as an area of potential ambiguity, and we've brought this bill forward to ensure that there is no ambiguity about the treatment of out-of-state-based contractors versus Minnesota-based contractors and the fact that they have the same obligations. This bill is consistent with current agency practice for implementing this program and does not expand the scope of which contracts are covered under this program or make other substantive changes to the statute. We've worked closely with Department of Administration on language, and with the adoption of today's amendments, we have the language that provides clarity for all parties and is workable for Department of Human Rights and Department of Administration. Specifically, this proposal merges the first two paragraphs of this section, paragraph A and paragraph B, into one, and then updates a little bit of outdated language and renumbers the sections as required. We appreciate the committee moving this forward to allow for this technical clarification to be made. I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee has. Thank you so much.
Any comments to add at this time, Representative Cantrell?
Not at this time, Mr. Chair. Okay.
A little bit of patience here. I see an amendment in E19, before you. Yeah. I'd like to move the amendment to E19. Everybody had a chance to look at it. We have an amendment to the amendment as well, so. Okay. What's your pleasure on the amendment to the amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment to the amendment is adopted. The amendment itself, the A19. What's your pleasure on the amendment? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, we have the bill in shape that the author so desires. Representative Cantrell. Anything to add at this point?
Not at this time, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for the opportunity to bring this bill before you, and we're here for questions. Yeah.
Questions to the testifier or the author? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Cantrell said in his opening comments that this clears up language, and Mr. Chair, I'm still confused. Earlier today we did House File 2000, and now we're doing 2001. And in 2000, Section 1 Subdivision 1, scope of application. We're just adding a half a sentence there. But in 2001, we're deleting the entire section. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I'm still missing something.
Can the author or the testifier please bring some clarity?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian. I appreciate your question. And again, apologies for bringing two bills on the same section on the same day and not having this as tidy as we would like to. So for the House File 2000, we worked with the reviser, and they wished to draft based on the existing statute, which has separate paragraphs A and B. And in those, they added the requirements around public officers or agencies subject to 16A.695, which is the geobond statute.
Yep.
So they wish to add it to that. With House File 2001 that's before us now, that actually is to clarify paragraphs A and B in Minnesota Statute 363A36, because we had some issues of potential ambiguity that were identified in our work with Department of Administration. So it actually merges those paragraphs together. But because this bill is still in process, as well as the other one being in process, the reviser couldn't draft to the newly merged language. And because the first issue is a more substantive policy question and this one was purely technical, the request was that we have these two travel separately.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that's clear. So in 2001, the underlying language that would be, I suppose, the new paragraph A, I guess, Representative Cantrell, where do you plan to fix this? Where is this going to be straightened out?
Representative Cantrell.
Between the two bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You can't do it in Ways and Means.
Representative Cantrell, could you answer that, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Fabian. I'm going to defer to Mr. Butel to add a little bit of clarification. That is, he was present earlier today for the hearing on that earlier bill, and he might be able to shed some light on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Fabian. My understanding in working with the reviser and drafting these two is they felt that if both of these were to pass, they would be able to make them consistent if these were both to pass as separate bills. So that is my understanding. Thank you.
I could tell you're as clear as I am, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative Fabian. Mr. Butel. Representative Denver.
Just a question. Why not just come with one bill to this committee? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Detmer. To iterate what Mr. Butel has said, it is my understanding that the reviser would rather draft from the current language and statute, the language that is being changed with this bill 2001, and then reconcile the two later on in the process. That's my understanding of how these two pieces of legislation interact.
And Mr. Chair, and Representative, when will that be reconciled? Thank you, Mr. Chair. When will it be reconciled?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cantrell, please.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. To iterate what Mr. Butel said, should both pieces of legislation pass this legislature, it is at that point in time that the reviser feels as though it's the Office of the Reviser will be able to reconcile the language in both of the bills. As Mr. Butel indicated, the contents of House File as a 2000 is more substantive, whereas it's a technical change. Reconciling the technical change with the substantive change made in House File 2000, it is my understanding, will be fairly seamless.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Detmer,
just to follow up here, but it still has to come back to a committee for the legislature to pass it. Am I correct there? To put it in law, the legislature has to put it in law.
Mr. Representative Detmer, if I may handle that one, Department of Human Rights is the Department of Human Rights is in judiciary, the committee. That's where this is going next, according to the path. Judiciary Civil Law Committee is also a policy committee. So. That's the future of this.
But
Representative Fabian.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. The House File 2000 went to Ways and Means. And this is going to, I believe you said judiciary?
Committee Administrator will clarify that for you. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Because we're a policy committee, when we refer things to divisions of Ways and Means, we have to send it to Ways and Means. There is no official way in the committee report process to include a recommendation. We made that mistake earlier this session. So we are sending both of these to Ways and Means, at which time they will then be memoed to the Judiciary and Civil Law Division, in which that's the department, that's where the jurisdiction is for the Department of Human Rights. That is the path for these two bills. But they're both sent. The other bill we sent was a different one that was sent directly to Judiciary and Civil Law, because that one is going to travel on its own separately.
Representative Fabian?
Note to the legislature. Let's combine these into one bill in the future.
Yes. Thank you, Representative Fabian. Let's blame it on the revisor. They're not here.
Oh, so. I didn't say that.
any questions to the author or the testifier? Okay, none. Anyone in the audience that wishes to weigh in? Thank you very much. Final words, Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for your time this evening. I hope that that you're able to get out of here at a reasonable hour.
Okay. I'm going to refer the 2001 to the, as amended, to the Ways and Means Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. You're on your way. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, we have House File 2274. Representative Coughlin. Coughlin. He said Coughlin. You said Coughlin. Let's get some clarity on this. Representative Coughlin. I'll make a motion to refer House File 2274 to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Chair. I have sat here and clarified the pronunciation of my last name a number of times. It is Representative Claflin, derivative of McLaughlin, if you really want to get into the history of it. I am bringing House File 2274 to you tonight because I am a member of the labor movement, and I strongly believe that we do not leave people behind. The Fair Labor Standards Act restricts the minimum wage and the hours worked, other workplace requirements. And in Minnesota, we have workers who are exempted from the Fair Labor Standards Act. There are about 39,000 workers in the state who do not earn overtime pay after reaching 40 hours in a work week. They have to reach 48 hours before they begin to earn overtime pay. And we are the only state in the country that has that limit at 48 hours. Kansas has a limit at 46 hours where you begin to earn overtime, and every other state in the nation begins to pay overtime at 40 hours. Excuse me. There are about 20,000 workers within the movie theater companies, vehicle mechanics, seasonal amusement employees, and other smaller categories of workers. And about 19,000 of those employees are agricultural workers. And the average pay for those employees ranges between $10 and $18 an hour. In your packets, there's also a handout that has all of the other states with their overtime hours listed. And you'll see that not only do other states all have the 40-hour limit before you begin to earn overtime, there are even states that will begin to pay overtime when you've worked more than 8 hours in a day, or when you work over 7 consecutive days. It is, frankly, time to bring our labor standards up to the same standards as the rest of the country. I have with me today Brad Leto from the AFL-CIO, who will also testify in support of this bill.
Welcome, Mr. Leto. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and labor members, for the second time today. I am Brad Leto, Secretary Treasurer of the Minnesota AFL-CIO, and here to testify in support of House Bill 2274, moving Minnesota in line with 48 other states by paying overtime after 40 hours. The bill is very straightforward. The House research summary from Mr. Weeks says it all. House File 2274 changes the number of hours in a week over which overtime is required to be paid from 48 to 40. This change would make the number of hours the same in the Minnesota Fair Labor Standards Act under Minnesota Statutes Chapter 177, the same as in the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act. Now, some may ask, why does the Minnesota AFL-CIO care about this issue? Don't unions have contracts that provide overtime after 48 hours of work? Yes, this is true. But the first sentence of the Minnesota AFL-CIO mission statement says, our goal is to improve the lives of working families, to bring economic justice to the workplace and social justice to our state and nation. Adopting a 40-hour work week certainly will improve the lives of almost 40,000 workers in the state. And people understand this. Just today, I went down in the elevator with a few ordinary people I did not know. They were inquisitive and asked, why was I here at the Capitol? I said, I work for Minnesota AFL-CIO, labor unions, and am here to advocate for a 40-hour work week for all. They were confused. And one woman said, you mean Minnesota does not have a 40-hour work week? I explained that federal law requires a 40-hour work week, but states had 40-hour work weeks to cover workers exempt from federal law. Then I said Minnesota is the only state that still had a 48-hour work week. Her comment said it all. She said, well, that is really archaic. I wish you the best of luck getting this passed this session. Regular people understand this issue. It is not hard to explain to people. The time to move Minnesota to a 40-hour work week is this year. Please vote yes to move House File 2274 forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Leto. Are there other testifiers? Please be seated, identify yourself, and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Representative Claflin. I'm Bruce Miller with the Minnesota Farmers Union. The issue we have with this particular bill is seeking some redress and some relief for Minnesota's farmers who grow perishable fruits and vegetables and who employ foreign guest workers. I'm going to just briefly tell you about the foreign guest worker program and then come back to my ask of the committee. First of all, in Minnesota, we have up to 150 farms who employ about 2,000 foreign guest workers on their farms. They pay them $13.54 per hour. They pay them, there is no deduction for federal, state, or local taxes. So $13.54 without federal, state, or local taxes. These farmers, these employees come from all over the world, many of them right now from Mexico, Central America, but also come from as far away as South Africa and from Eastern Europe. The farmers who employ these by contract, this is a federal program, by contract provide the legal and visa costs, the recruiting agent costs in their home countries, the travel costs, the per diem travel expenses. They provide government-inspected housing on their farms. They provide workers' comp insurance. They provide vehicles and fuel so people can get food and clothing. They provide specialty clothing and tools such as boots, rain gear, which today makes sense, and other tools. They are paid at least every other week. The wages are, again, as I said, free of federal and state and local taxes. Our Minnesota farmers are at an economic disadvantage, these up to 150 farmers, because the people they are employing are foreign guest workers under a program called the H-2A program. Our farmers are looking at not being competitive with our surrounding states who do not have the kind of overtime, agricultural overtime hours that Minnesota does. In Minnesota, these farmers pay overtime at 48 hours and above. This would drop that down, and there would be a significant cost increase to them compared to other states. Right now, what I understand is that in the grocery stores, produce is now coming in from Michigan because it can be grown more cost-effectively there because of their hour situation, and they can ship it here and still beat the farmers who are growing in Burnsville or in Wright County or in other parts. This affects produce growers. It affects apple growers. These are perishable products. The foreign guest workers that come here aren't coming here, and none of them are seeking citizenship. And this isn't about immigration, and it isn't about a wall. This is about people who are coming here to earn a living, to spend to earn as much money as they can, to send it home to wherever home is, and after 6 to 9 months, go home with that kind of with the kind of money they simply can't get, and their economic and their family's economic conditions are greatly improved. So I'm here tonight not to argue about 48-40, but I'm here to say that Minnesota's family farmers who do produce need some relief and some redress. This legislation, frankly, at a time of pretty dramatic economic downturn, you may have heard the phrase being used, we're in year five of a three-year downturn in farming. One farmer last night, when he called me at home to talk to me about this bill, said this would be the equivalent of a barn collapse on my business. I think this is serious, and we hope, and I thank Representative Clapham for bringing it forward, that this provides us with an opportunity to have this kind of a dialogue ongoing in terms of can we fix this for this set of farmers who are using foreign guest workers? Can we, as is in the law now for resort owners who also bring in foreign guest workers, can we create an exception? Can we craft something? We didn't ask anyone on this committee tonight to think about an amendment that would do that, but I would posture that I would suggest that as we go forward, can we take a look at that? Can we have this dialogue? And secondly, I want to put forward an offer that the farmers I work with are seriously making. This summer, they would like you to come out on their farms. They would like you to see what it is they're doing. They would like you to meet their workers. And when I say meet their workers, they're not standing over them. They say go talk to them and they tell their employees, be as honest as you can. And so we want you to see these farms. We want you to see the kind of economic opportunities that are being impacted here. Minnesota Farmers Union supports legislative efforts as policy. Our policy, what our members have voted on, is we support legislative efforts to remove the overtime requirement for seasonal H-2A foreign guest workers employed in the growing of perishable farm products. As long as those visa holders are receiving the payment for the adverse wage rate for all employees, are provided housing and local transportation, as well as the payment of transportation costs to and from their country of origin. And finally, guaranteed compensation equal to 3/4 of the total work days of the contracted period. These are farmers who treat their employees well. These are not farmers who are abusing their employees. And this is the kind of legislation that they feel would be disastrous. And just for me, one final thing. I know these farmers. Many of them live right very near the metropolitan area. That's how they get they're in the surrounding counties. And I have to say, some of these folks would like to pass on their farms to the next generation, and they would like to help younger farmers get started, but they're also in highly developable property, thousands of acres being now under produce that's being perishable, fruit and vegetables, and we would just soon farmers be successful and not be forced out of business or forced into dire consequences. Mr. Chairman, committee members, I thank you. Representative Claflin, look forward to talking about this more as this proceeds forward to wherever it goes. I might add that I think I heard you said it was going to jobs. Because of its impact on agriculture, I would also suggest that you consider or that the legislature consider having it reviewed by the Agriculture Committee, and maybe bring in the Department of Agriculture to ask the Department of Agriculture their perspective on that. So, Mr. Chairman, I rest, and if you've got any questions, I'd be happy to address them.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Very good suggestions. Questions to the testifier or the author? Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, curious, do you have any estimate of all of those different costs, what that might go into as far as an hourly overall payment?
Mr. Chairman, Representative.
Mr. Miller.
If you were one of these foreign guest workers, you would be paid $13.54 per hour. That is your rate of pay, and that is, and nothing's taken out of it. Is that answer? I'm not sure I understood the question. If not,
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess what I was looking at is all of the other costs that were with the housing and everything else. It sounds like there is a significant amount that, if you looked at it from an hourly basis, if anybody's calculated that out to see what they're really paid.
Mr. Chairman, Representative.
Mr. Miller.
I must attest that is the one sheet of paper that's still lying on my dining room table, because I wrote it down last night when I got home from over here about 9 o'clock. I can tell you that it's far in excess of $20 an hour, probably approaches almost double the cost of the actual wage rate. So when you add in housing, auto, travel, you're looking at thousands and thousands of dollars per employee. So beyond that, I will try to get you the information, though.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was my suspicion, that it could easily be doubled. So.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Vogel. I would like everybody to take notice that we have snacks, compliments of the Speaker Hartman, and thank you very much. Any other questions? Representative Jean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Claflin. I just had a quick question on line 1.10. To line 1.12, the line that states, the state of Minnesota or a political subdivision may grant time off at the rate of 1.5 hours for each hour worked in excess of 40 hours in a work in a week in lieu of monetary compensation. I was wondering why 48 and not 40. I'm not familiar with this process. So can you share with me why 48 and not 40 hours? If we're going to be changing to 40 hours everywhere else.
To the author.
Chair and Representative Zhang, that's a very good question. I had not noticed that, and I think that will be part of the ongoing conversation that we have. Thank you very much for pointing that out.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, to that point, it looks like maybe that's a carve-out for government and not for private employers. Representative Claflin, you said, I think in your opening comments, I wrote it down here, I actually have two different numbers. I think you said 30,000 employees were not covered by the FLSA. Can you rename those for me again?
Representative Claflin.
I got agriculture.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, the total estimate from the Bureau of Labor Statistics and Department of Economic Development is about 39,000 total. Yeah. About 19,000 are within the agricultural codes. About 20,000 come from other employment categories. About 2,500 work in movie theaters. About 6,300 are vehicle mechanics at dealerships. About 8,500 folks work in seasonal amusements and recreation, and a number of other small categories make up about 2,700 employees doing jobs like broadcast news editors and announcers in the non-metro area, domestic service providers who are living within homes, or employees who are receiving remedial training.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm not sure I understand where this is coming from, because, like in movie theaters, they're dealing in interstate commerce. Shouldn't the FLSA cover those employees? Why is that not, I mean, to me it's obvious.
Representative Claflin?
Chair and Representative Fabian, yes, if a business does engage in interstate commerce, they are subject to the Fair Labor Standards Act. Not every movie theater, however, is engaged in business across multiple states. I think we would have to ask a labor lawyer for more details.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, those must, Mr. Chair, those must be the movies that they show in those theaters that are made just here in Minnesota then, because, anyway. And again, I appreciate what you're doing, what you're trying to do here, but as we heard from the other testifier, the ideology is good, but the reality, it doesn't work. You talked about coming out to the farms next summer. Well, I'll be there. I'll be driving tractor for one of my neighbors during planting season and so forth. But the 48 hours there in egg country during the busy times when it were planting and sugar beet harvest, any kind of harvesting that's going on, I don't see how this is going to work in the egg community. And farmers are really smart people. And if you put something like this on them, what they're going to do is take away from something else. It's not going to be something that they just absorb during this very, very difficult time in the ag economy. They may lower their hourly wage. You know, I know how much I made when I was driving beet topper last fall. And if by chance this were to be in effect in that the beet harvest time, instead of getting paid $20 or $25 an hour, they're going to get paid $15 or $20 an hour so that they can cover the overtime costs. So, and again, I appreciate, you know, the idea that you want people to be treated and paid more, but I just don't think that that this is going to work in ag country at this time. And it's more of a statement than a question, obviously, Mr. Chair. And I hope that we reconsider this and do something else. In one other question, would the forestry industry be covered in this in any way? Loggers and so forth?
Representative Claflin?
Chair, I am not sure if the forestry industries would be exempt or non-exempt employees. I think that's another question for a labor lawyer. And further, I would welcome working more with the agricultural community. So this is a proposal that works for everyone in Minnesota. I think we have a solid piece of information to negotiate on, work forward with this information about the visa holders. And I also want to point out that the sugar beet employees that are employed as hand laborers and paid on a piece rate basis, if there's a certain level of pay there, they are also exempt from this limit.
Thank you. Representative Fabian?
Well, just one last question. So before this evening, Representative Claflin, what farmers have you talked to about this?
Representative Claflin.
I have not discussed this with farmers. I'm certain that it would affect their business. But I've done some basic math, and we hear over and over how tight everyone's margins are, and I believe everyone's margins are tight. For an employee who's making $15 an hour, if they're working 40 hours, they're paid $600. If they're working 48 hours at $15 an hour, they make $720. If they're going to be paid the overtime for the difference of those 8 hours between 40 and 48, it's a difference of $60. They would be making $780 for 48 hours of work instead of $720. $60 is a fairly small margin on what they're being paid.
Representative Fabian.
Two things, Mr. Chair. Well, first of all, if they're doing that in the egg sector, what's going to happen is they're not going to start at the 15. Oh, I apologize. If I was the chair, that would be a fine. So,
how much you got?
I'll make sure that I'll make sure that the next time we're at the Tin Cup together, I'll buy you supper. They're going to start out at a lower wage, so they're going to make the difference. And Mr. Chair, I'd ask for a roll call on this.
Thank you. Any other questions to the testifier or the author? Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would request a roll call, but I do have a question or two. I'm curious, Representative, if there are any other extenuating circumstances for, like, these theater employees or mechanical employees and so forth, because it sounds as if it was kind of a carve-out for specific situations. Are you aware if that's going on with any of these other groups as well?
Representative Claflin.
Chair and Representative Vogel, I'm not sure what the reasoning behind those exemptions was. Again, a question for a labor lawyer, perhaps.
Representative Vogel?
Thank you. And just point of information, you know, it would appear to me that there's about 15 workers per farm, so if it's $80 a week extra and there, it's coming to $840 a week. Now, I don't know how long they work during the summer, but, you know, if they're working 10, 12 weeks or whatever, you're talking possibly thousands of dollars here on the overtime, even if it is only $80 a week. So I do think that it is worth exploring what's going on here, because that could be a significant financial impact on these people. So thank you.
Representative Fabian.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I apologize, Farmers Union.
Bruce.
Yeah, thank you.
Chairman.
So are any of the workers that come that you referred to, if they agree to work for a salary instead of an hourly wage, what would happen then?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, this is kind of a, you know, it's kind of like we're looking at apples and strawberry trees or something, because this is federally dictated. There isn't the ability to do it by contract. Okay. This is a federal thing, and it's the wages are non-negotiable. These wages are set via the federal government. So when I'm saying it's that rate right now, that's calculated every year, and that has been ratcheting up per state each and every year as well. So, for instance, a vegetable farmer in Wright County can't say, well, overtime is busting me, I'm going to pay you $10 an hour, because he can't, because that's not a part of the agreement with the federal government and the the international exchange to bring these foreign guest workers here. It's a prescribed amount. And so what happens now is what can happen is during peak harvest, planting harvest time, summertime, fall time, the farmers are finding themselves having to pay overtime to almost a point where they're not making any money on the per piece item that's being harvested, pumpkins, for instance. Their option is to pay this overtime and not make any money, or to set these employees down, in this case now in Minnesota, at 48 hours. And now we have primarily young men sitting in a house on a Wednesday night or Thursday because their hours are in for the week. We feel like, and our farmers feel like, that's a recipe for trouble. What these folks coming in, is when you come out and talk to them, you're going to find that they want to be out there and they want to work as many hours. They're not dissatisfied with their wages. They're not dissatisfied with their living conditions. They want to put as much money as they can in the bank, and they like their farmers, and they come back year after year. So I think that's one of the kind of controlling things. I think as we have this conversation, I think we have to be very clear that we need to, in some ways, separate out agricultural workers from the rest of this conversation, and maybe try to figure out how do we get to a reasonable working solution that benefits our farmers and benefits the people working, whether they're foreign guest workers or others. That was a long answer to your question.
But a good one.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I have the same concerns about the farm issues that we have here. I know in my area there's several farms or greenhouses and vegetable farms, and a lot of their work is being done now where they're planting these seedlings in the greenhouses, and when it comes to the right weather, when we get rid of the snow, well, then they're out in the fields. So that's a concern that I have, too, with this legislation.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Miller.
Foreign guest workers are already here in the United States. One of our farmers, the one that called me last night at 9 o'clock, 2 weeks ago in the middle of that snowstorm, was the night they flew in. So he was less than excited about having to go to the airport and get them. But they're in the greenhouses. You're right.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Any other questions for the testifier or the author? Representative Zhang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Claflin, thank you so much for bringing this bill forward. I think that as we discuss wage theft, we need legislation like this to address this ongoing issue, especially when we're talking about bills like this. We're talking about communities of color, communities, underserved communities who really need this so that we are addressing the issues that they are facing in the labor industry. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Any responses?
Yes, thank you, Chair and Representative Zhang. I do absolutely agree that this is time to have this conversation, and we can certainly have this conversation with awareness of the agricultural community and how they will be affected, and how the employees within the agricultural community will be affected. And I also want to remind the rest of the committee that it is not only agricultural workers who will be affected by this. There are more than half of the employees in Minnesota that's estimated to be not covered by the 40-hour overtime limit do not work in the agricultural fields. I would encourage the committee to continue to work with me on this bill to make it as strong as we can for all Minnesotans and for the folks that are coming here and helping us harvest the fresh fruits and vegetables that we all enjoy year-round.
I do have a question myself, if everyone else is through. Thank you. To whoever might answer this, Mr. Leto would have input on this as well. Regarding the guest worker visas, we've got a list of these other states that has been provided, agricultural states, and I'm just wondering how many of those entertain workers on guest visas?
Mr. Chairman, there are foreign guest workers, I believe, in almost, if not all 50 states, probably all 50 states are near it. And I don't have the numbers per state, but I'm going to try to get them as we move this forward. This is a secondary problem at the federal level is because of the federal shutdown. The federal government is so far behind on processing visas that we have farmers all over America waiting for their foreign guest workers to actually arrive. And the other piece of that, and we can find this out because each and every one of those, foreign guest workers, I might add, has a contract. These are people with contracts who have an official contract with the farmer to do this work. So when we're talking about these workers and we're talking about possible exceptions, we are talking about people with contracts. I think Representative Zhang knows how much I care about the same issues he does. And I just want to say that that's another whole kettle of something that we could discuss. So, but we will try to find that out, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Any other questions remaining? Representative Claflin, you'll get the last word.
Thank you very much, Chair Sundin. I'm looking forward to continuing to work on this bill. I do think this is very important to bring Minnesota up to the standards that the rest of the country follows. We're surrounded by other agricultural states. They have a 40-hour overtime standard. We can do the same. Thank you.
Thank you very much. At this time, I'm going to renew my motion to refer House File 2274 to the Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Excuse me, roll call. Sorry. And Andy Gergensen will call the roll.
Representative Sundin.
I'd be an aye.
Representative Vogel.
No.
Representative Claflin.
Yes.
Representative Detmer.
No.
Representative Eklund.
Yes.
Representative Fabian.
No, I'm sorry.
Representative Fornstein.
Yes.
Representative Purcell.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Yes.
The motion passes 6-3. We are adjourned.